Alan Kring Productions in association with the Emergent Light Studio presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Financial Management, MBA 440 for Spring Semester 2022.
Today, cash flow analysis. And as I said before the lecture started, I'm going to begin with a couple of important side streams. And I will hold you to these on the exam as well. Some terminology, some ways of thinking about markets and what they mean as far as the larger picture goes in finance and as far as the picture goes at the level of an individual firm. How does a company's economic environment impacted? You see, and I've talked about this before, there are two kinds of risk that are inherent in a company. But actually, that's almost a little too simplistic. And the book hints around in chapter 11 at these nuances of risk. But to start out with, there's standalone risk. That is just the risk of that company on its own. The market's buffeting of the company, along with the company's own buffeting of itself through its decision-making peculiarities. That standalone risk includes all of the risks. And they discuss this in the chapter. And you've heard it before. Now, where we see this from an outside perspective is in the volatility of the stock returns of the company. The overall stock return volatility, the ups and downs and ups and downs. The sigma of the stock, the standard deviation of returns. You get the returns from, like month to month, and you get those for a long run of years, and you can see that standalone risk of that individual company and its stock. So in order to show you that, what I'll do here is I'm going to take you to a website that might be worth you putting in a little bookmark somewhere in the back of your browser, onestockone.com. The amazing thing about this, it's not a commercial site per se. It has been run for a very long time, even before there was what we know now as the internet. This is a massive database of the returns to indexes of stocks, exchanges all over the world, the stock returns of individual stocks themselves. All kinds of data is here. Let me show you, for example. I can find the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the index going back to 1975. That is a lot of years of the returns year by year. And I think I showed you this in a previous lecture. But if you go back to the beginning, you can find individual stocks. You name it, you can find it here. Now, I'm going to open up an Excel spreadsheet, and I'm going to show you the standalone risk in real life. Now, this will be for annual returns. Really, you would want to do this monthly returns, but this will do for us for tonight. You got a stock of a company? Anything we want to see? Okay. I will not do Tesla. I will not cater to that mental monkey who runs that miserable parasite. Oh, anyway, sorry, I lost it there for a second. My bad. Okay. Yeah, now he's going to buy Twitter so he can say whatever he wants on there. Jeez, good God. Never mind. Okay, let me find something. So now that I'm sorry, I asked for your suggestions. Let's do. I know one. U.S. Steel. Well, can I do U.S. Steel? Its trading symbol is X. Okay. So I'll have to do it by the trading symbol. X. X, Y, Xenon. Nope, they're not. How would I do it? U.S. Steel. I'm finally looking for one. Oh, there we go. Yeah. Oh, no, that one goes back to only 1992. So I need something that's going to go clear back. I want to use as many years as possible to do this. I don't know. I hate it when I just draw a blank. Oh, here's one. Ford. Oh, don't tell. Yeah, Ford. There we go. Now, the nice thing about this is that it gives you the returns. You can calculate the returns yourself. Year one minus year zero divided by year zero and all that. Or year one. Come on. I'm going to do this cheap way. Now, look at this. What in the heck happened last year? Do you see Ford last year, what its return was on the stock? What was that about? I don't follow the auto industry that closely, so I got nothing on what happened there. That's just appalling. 136.29% return last year Ford did. I'm going to ignore that because that is an anomalous, and I'm going to talk about that anyway. I'm glad I'm doing this one because that gives me a chance. Control C, and then I'm going to just toss this into a here. Paste. Oops. I didn't catch that other line, so I'll have to put it in here. Now, insert a line here. Year. And over here, return. So what I'm doing here is the next step in this is called parsing the data. I'm going to get rid of the parts of the data that I don't need for what I'm going to do here. So I'm going to get rid of these. I'm going to look in the center here, delete these. Now, standalone risk is just going to be equal to the standard deviation, and you use STDEV. There are a lot of different. Wait, let me go back here. Do you see how there are all these different STDEVs that you can use? Don't. This is a sample, and a sample uses the differences between each observation and the average squared, divided by the number of observations minus one. The population standard deviation divides by the number of standard deviation, the number of observations. You don't want that. You want the sample. And STDEV is the sample. That's the one that you should almost always use, unless you have gotten all of the data that could possibly be acquired. So STDEV. Oops, I did that in the wrong place. There it is. Okay, whoops, I want to format that to a percentage with two decimal places so it looks like the returns themselves. Okay. This is a staggering standard deviation. This says that, well, let me insert a line here and do the average. The average return for a year and the standard deviation. The average is equal to average. Go back up here and do them again. Now, the average is a 15.73% return per year. That is an excellent return over a long period of time to an individual stock. But you see that massive standard deviation? That is not unusual for a company. Most companies, if you buy a stock on its own, there is going to be a huge amount of whipsaw in the price, in the return on that stock from year to year. In this case, we are actually saying that about 67% of the returns on the stock occur between the average minus one standard deviation and the average plus one standard deviation. Look at that wild. 67% of the time, you're going to, in any given year, be somewhere between losing almost 50% and gaining over 75%. That is wild, the standard deviation. That is standalone risk. That is the entire risk of the company's returns, the stock returns. That comprises two pieces. The systematic risk and the non-systematic company risk. Company-specific risk. In a well-diversified portfolio, this part vanishes because they cancel each other out. One company is getting wildly great one year while another company is doing badly, and that individual company piece cancels out. And I've talked about this before in this class, but here is a wild example of what happens if you buy a single stock for a portfolio. One year, you're going to be dancing in the streets, and the next year, you're going to be looking for razor blades to kill yourself with so you don't have to explain to your family that you have to leave your home forever. So this gives you an idea of how powerful that standalone risk is in a company. Now, there are two ways that a company can take this. A company can say, we need to calm down, mature, so that we don't have this wild swinging risk that is being caused by the peculiarities of our company. We have very strong policies of corporate governance. We have expectations of productivity, and we don't have a whole lot of tolerance for low productivity. We do everything by this conservative, controlled standard. It is an effort to manage that non-systematic risk. You are looking at Ford, which is an old, well-established, well-disciplined company, and look at how wild it is. To give you this in context, when we look at only systematic risk, the way we measure that is, as I had shown you before, with the beta of the company. And to do that, we're going to look at Yahoo. Now remember, a beta above one is a risky company. It has a lot of systematic risk. Even in a well-diversified portfolio, it's going to behave badly. It's going to behave wildly. Now some people love that. They want that risk. They want a greater risk, greater expected return. Let's look at Ford. Now what we're going to see when we look at beta is only its systematic risk. It's a little above the average risk of a company. One would be like right in the middle. The risk of the market is the risk of the company. Now you can see that this company is a little above one, but it is certainly nothing that would justify, that would be associated with an insane wild ride of a 62% standard deviation. So as you can see, that non-systematic component can be a very large, very strong part of a company. I'm going to take another one from another industry here. I want to go back here. And I'm going to take a company, another company that is an older, well-established company. So what we would probably do is maybe a banking company. And to look at banks, maybe something like KeyBank. Or well, actually, there are a lot of banks that I could use. Wells Fargo. I don't know if that's going to be a good idea, but Wells Fargo. I don't know if they go back. Yep, they go back all the way. So let's again look at one of these. And let's see how their behavior is. Control C. And we're going to put this over here and put this, paste. Something went wrong that time. I do this so often, I don't understand why I've done something weird here. Let me take these. Maybe it caught something that it didn't like. Control C. Put it down here. Yeah. Okay, so now let me parse out the parts that I don't want. Delete. And then put these over there. Control C. Control V. Okay, now let's look at this one. Oh, I'm going to take out this one too. That's right. Okay, so now let me copy these over. Control. A much quieter company. It has a very low risk compared to Ford. And that is not unusual. Now let's look at Wells Fargo as far as the beta is concerned. Well, isn't that interesting? Its beta is even worse. What that would tell us is that these are two very different companies. Ford is a company where the standalone risk is heavily influenced by non-systematic risk. Wells Fargo is a company where the standalone risk is not nearly as much a result of non-systematic risk. Very, very different companies. But the point that I am trying to get to is that the standard deviation is not a good measure in and of itself of a stock in a well-diversified portfolio. But if you are investing in an individual stock, the standard deviation is what you should look at. And the cautionary tale is you pays your penny and you takes your chances. In some cases, the standalone risk is heavily dominated by non-systematic risk that you could have gotten rid of. In other cases, the standalone risk is not nearly as significant. And that would mean that it, in this case, that there is not very much non-systematic risk in the company. Now, how does this translate into what we're doing in this course and in especially in this section, this part of the course? Within a company itself, we're going back to standalone risk. Within a company itself, there are a number of sources of risk, of volatility in the cash flows. The first one, not surprisingly, is revenue. Revenue goes up and down. it is a source of risk for the company. This is what is classically called business risk. Business risk is the risk of the revenues. It is their ups and downs. Now, you take away the cost of goods sold, and you get gross income. The cost of goods sold is not a source of any risk. You're saying, wait, what? Because it's a variable cost. It does not contribute any additional volatility that is not already in the revenues. As the revenues go up and down, the cost of goods sold goes up and down with it. So there's no additional risk being created by that cost of goods sold. Think about this. You and I, we're dance partners. Dut, 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 dut. We're moving back and forth together. So the motion of one is the motion of the other. So the motion of us, a damn fine dancing pair, as opposed to a dancing bear, is not going to move hardly at all with this. There's no extra risk from you. Now, suppose that you didn't come one night, you didn't show up. So I have to get a cardboard cutout, a dummy, and put it there. So now, as I flow back and forth as revenues, I keep running into you. You become a source of risk. A fixed cost is a source of risk. A variable cost is not a source of risk. So if I am looking at these financials as I flow down the line, oh, well, right here, this is a single compact source of risk. It is business risk. So the gross income line is where you could measure the gross income line, get a standard deviation, and you would see a risk, a sigma, a standard deviation. Now, usually we use a coefficient of variation so we can compare large-scale operations to small-scale operations, but we'll leave it here for a minute. Okay, now let's go down. We have the depreciation expense, which isn't really a cost at all. It just sits there looking stupid. So we'll put it in with the sales, general, and administrative expenses. These are actually, to a large extent, fixed costs. They create a risk. Fixed cost risk, and we'll call this one fixed cost risk one. Now, here's an interesting thing. Companies have developed this fascinating way of transferring that risk. They do it two ways. One way that they transfer the risk is by simply outsourcing. So as their production goes up, they outsource more. As production goes down, they outsource less. So they are no longer exposed to sales, general, and administrative expenses nearly to the extent that a company that internalizes its operations is. You see, in my world, when I want prints done, I could do it myself. I could have a ginormous, extremely high-quality, expensive printer. Now, the inks would be, obviously, a cost that would be fixed. But I would need someone to operate that. Instead, I outsource my printing so that when I need more prints, I just order more. When I need fewer prints, I order fewer. So in other words, companies outsource quite specifically to remove a risk, to remove a fixed cost risk that the company would otherwise incur. There are companies now, and you will be seeing them more in the future. Fast food, you pull up, And they say, may I help you, McPlease? And you say, yes, Mick, I want a McFood. Well, you know what they're doing? You will be surprised. Some of them are already doing it. You're actually ordering the food in from a call center in India, which processes the order and then sends it back to the order line for production. Another word, and those call centers, they charge you by the order, your company, as opposed to you hiring an employee that you have to pay the wage to, whether you have a high volume or a low volume, and also the benefits if there are things like that. So in other words, there's an example of outsourcing right there that turns an otherwise semi-fixed cost into a purely variable cost. That's all there is to it. It's just a variable cost. So in other words, it is no longer a risk to you. Okay, so now, another way that they do it, and this is something you have seen, it began many years ago in antivirus software, and it is now in major mainline software. By Adobe and by Microsoft are the champions of it. They have turned boxed purchase of your software into rental by subscription. In other words, from shrink wrap to subscription. So in other words, they no longer have to produce X number of boxes in their costs down here. It's no longer fixed. All they do is take it from you, and then you are stuck with the fixed cost of the subscription for a year. So they have transferred a fixed cost risk from themselves to their customers. That's another way that they can do this. So now, we get down here and we get to the operating income, otherwise known as the earnings before interest and taxes. Now, the next line that comes along is the interest expense. This is fixed cost risk two, otherwise known as the financial risk. The financial risk. It is a fixed cost. You have to pay it whether you make $100,000 or $2 because it's the bondholders. They must be paid or they will put the company into bankruptcy. So they're frozen. You're frozen with this. So in other words, this creates a risk that goes up as you have higher and higher debt load in your company. Again, one of the sources of the standalone risk that is company specific. Understand that these risks are not there in a well-diversified portfolio. All of this company specific risk isn't there except for the top line, which should be moving the same for a lot of companies. Now we get to the earnings before taxes, sometimes known as pre-tax. This one is sometimes called EBT, and also I should have mentioned this up here, the operating income line, and I've said all this before, so this is kind of review. This is called EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes. Okay? Interestingly, the taxes, as long as we have a progressive tax structure, the taxes will not be a source of risk. They are, yes, affixed, but they move up and down with your pre-tax. So they are flowing. As you make less money, they go down. As you make more money, they go up. So they are not independently a source of risk. That all changes, and it did change in 2017 when we went to a fixed rate of 21% for corporate taxes. Suddenly, it becomes an actual source of risk because it's the same. Okay, it's still a percentage, so it does have a lot of variable to it. But it is, again, a little bit more now, because it doesn't matter what you make, that tax will stay the same. So anyway, we pay our tax, which is a source of risk, but we'll leave that one. And then you get your net income. So you see that by the time you get down here to accounting profit, you are reflecting a lot of different sources of risk within a company. And in a case like Ford, you can see that those sources of risk reflected in stock returns wildly, which tells you that along these lines here, they were just piling up risks over the years. And like I said, companies do try to mitigate these. Companies outsource. That's a big one. Companies don't borrow a lot of money so that they don't get into that fixed cost trouble there. And companies do everything they can to lessen their tax burdens through loopholes and offshore operations and all that kind of stuff. So when we look at something like this, we are seeing the structure of Sigma. And more importantly, we're actually seeing the structure of the part of Sigma that is not systematic. That's a lot of what Chapter 11 is trying to get across to you. As you go through it, they work around and talk about these things, but they never actually hit it right on the head. What we're looking at is the analysis of the individual company tonight, not the analysis of stocks, not the analysis of markets. We're looking at the analysis of individual enterprises. Why would we want to do that? The argument would be companies shouldn't worry about this. They shouldn't. Because sophisticated investors are going to diversify their portfolios so that ultimately they are going to get rid of our peculiar risks themselves, our company-specific risks. They'll get rid of it themselves by diversifying their portfolios. It's not our job to hold the hand of the investor. If an investor wants to be stupid and buy just our stock, well, that's the investor's choice. But we are in the business of just doing what we do, our enterprise, our business, our comparative advantage, as it were. And so that argument says this shouldn't matter to the outside investor. Does it matter? Does it not matter? Well, that is actually something of an opinion. A number of these talk show hosts, they concentrate on individual stocks. They talk about you should buy this, you should sell this. So we know that investors are being influenced to buy individual stocks and therefore face these risks. So companies are mindful that, yeah, we do have investors who are exposed to our individual risks. Is that our problem? Some companies say, yes, it is. We want to take care of our shareholders. Other companies say, no, it's not our business. We shouldn't be worrying about this. To some extent, obviously companies aren't going to let their risks go insane inside here. But at the same time, they don't want to obsess on this matter right here. Taking that as the backdrop of what we're doing tonight, the question still comes down to why do we look at the individual company? There are a number of branches of finance. You are actually in a course called financial management. That falls under the general heading of corporate finance. Now, I taught you about investments and all that kind of stuff, stocks and bonds. But this is truly a corporate finance course. This is for you as a participant in a corporation, an individual corporation, where you have to look at that corporation and its books and its performance, its own standard deviation. You're in the fishbowl, So you need to know about individual company risk and all of the parts of it and all of the things we do to find out about it. The big thing is that we don't care about profit. That is something for the accountants. Now understand that a corporate finance person is going to talk about profit. We do that because that is what everyone else in the company thinks matters until they finally, we can kind of enlighten them. Sooner or later, they begin to understand that profit really isn't what mattered, especially if the company starts getting having problems, even though they have a good profit line. They start asking the question, well, why is this happening? And then we can kind of pipe up and say, it's because you're ignoring the real thing that we should look at, which is free cash flow. As I mentioned earlier in the course, Caterpillar, obsessed on profit for decades. And finally, about 7-8 years ago, they finally said, we're not good. We're profitable, but we're struggling. Why the hell should this be happening? And that's when the finance people stepped up to the plate and they said, it's because you haven't been looking at free cash flow. Free cash flow is everything. And free cash flow is what we're going to look at right now. And I've shown you this before, and now we hit home. Because it's not just free cash flow that has already happened. We need to project free cash flow out. Because that's how we're going to know, do we need external financing? If I find out that in year 0, year 1, year 2, free cash flow is, let's say, $20 million. Year one, it's negative $8 million. And year two, it is recovering to $4 million. That negative $8 million is not a number in a book. That number, 8 million, means we got to find that because that was actually calculated from operations. And we're saying that we don't have $8 million that we need to have for this company to operate. That's why this matters, is that's not an abstraction. We will turn off the company. We don't have the money to pay. So if we don't understand this by a projection, we walk right into it, and all of a sudden, oh my God, what do we do? What do you do in a situation like that? Well, you can get fast financing, and it will be expensive AF if you suddenly have to scramble to get $8 million. You're not going to just call up your friendly banker and say, hey, you got $8 million kicking your ass? You need to pre-plan for it. You need to be on the horn in year 0, at least, maybe year negative 1, with the investment bankers saying, we are projecting that our free cash flow will be $8 million down, so we need that much financing to be in the to be able to pay our bills in year 1. So that the investment bankers say, okay, let's structure it. We'll do bonds, stocks. We got to look at your optimal capital structure, all of that. And everything can be in place so that you go into that year and you are able to take care of that deficit. You write the checks as you need to. You take care of the problems that you have. And it's like nothing happened at all. And here in year 0, somewhere near towards the middle of the year, there's this big announcement, investment banking syndicate is going to do an offering of stock of this company. Isn't that great? Not explaining that they projected that the reason they need that equity capital is because they aren't going to be able to function without it next year. The same would be true of a debt issue. Netflix walked into a free cash flow situation that was insanely dark. It was $1.2 billion negative free cash flow. If you had looked at Netflix's books, Their accounting profit was okay. Why in the hell would you go out and need $1.2 billion? And they needed it so bad that they were willing to pay a coupon rate that made that debt listed as junk bonds. They were in such a bad situation. Why were they in that bad situation? Because somewhere back here, they had not been projecting free cash flows, so they did not see it coming until it was right there sitting in their faces, and all of those lenders, yeah, boy, that's going to take a lot to get that money together this fast. Yeah, we'll do it, but we're going to charge you out the ass for the coupon on that. Hence, Netflix is now, for the next 15 years, paying a much higher interest rate than it would have if it had planned back here and slowly acquired the money through quiet debt issues and bonds and did a seasoned offering of stock. They would not have been in that position where they were that desperate. That's why free cash flow matters. Because, okay, you're going to have a negative year. A couple of things are going to be clear here. In year zero, oh, we always pay a dividend. Well, maybe you ought to get your investors used to a little bit less dividend so that you don't have your $20 million, you're not blowing $5 million of it on dividends. Maybe you ought to lay off that so that you have more free cash in year one so that you're not in such a hole, all those kinds of things. Preparing ahead of time is a lot better than preparing while the alligators are starting to eat your butt in the swamp. And yes, I do give great analogies. So, free cash flow. And I've shown you this before, and you'll notice that this is one of the things that I come back to because it is so important in corporate finance, free cash flow. Now, the thing about free cash flow is that we look at what is called unlevered free cash flow. We look at the free cash flow without considering interest expense because interest expense is not an operating cash flow. It's something that is not causing the company to operate better or worse. It is just there, you pay it. And so what we do is we begin by doing the old revenues minus costs. To get your gross income. And then we subtract out the depreciation expense. Now, this is not a real expense, but it does create a tax shield. By subtracting this, even though it's not there, we pay a lower tax. And then our sales, general, and administrative expenses, those are operating expenses again. We get down to our operating income, the EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes. This is where we separate from the accountants. We do not subtract interest expense. We calculate the tax that is occurring because of operations. We calculate the tax that is occurring only because of the operations of the company. So at this minus the tax on EBIT. And that gets us the net operating income after taxes. The first leg of our holy grail, NOPAT. That's our first step. So, putting it in quick terms, operating income times 1 minus the corporate tax rate that would apply. Now, back in the day, we would have taken the top marginal tax bracket for a company of that size. Any company that was above $18 million, at $18 million, something like $333,000, you went to the top marginal tax bracket, which was 39%. So that would have been 1 minus 0.39. Interestingly, the very largest companies on Earth pay a lower tax back in the day. They paid 0.35, but we kind of ignored that. Now it's 0.21. The tax bracket for a corporation is 21%. So it has gone down, so it's not 1 minus 0.39 anymore for a big company. It's 1 minus 0.21 for a big company. Interestingly, a number of the finance textbooks are still using 39%. Are we going to go back down to 21%? That's speculative. We had thought that that Tax Act of 2017 would be at least partially set aside with the Congress that was elected in 2020 and the president who's in office right now. But they ran into some hardcore resistance from a couple of more conservative Democrats who said, no, they get their campaign money from giant corporations, so of course they're not going to agree to raise the tax rate back to the old 39%. So we're still stuck with 0.21, not 0.39. For now, we'll see what happens after the election. Not likely we'll get anywhere with it after the election, but there's that. So there is NOPAT. This is our first round. NOPAT. Now, we need to talk about actual cash that comes and goes from a company, the actual money. Not abstractions, not depreciation expense. So we have to add back that depreciation expense because it never actually happened. We allow it in here because it's going to cut the operating income, which means that our pre-tax is going to be lower than it would if we had not put that depreciation expense in there. But once that's in there, we need to get back on the program here and say, okay, add the depreciation expense back in because it wasn't real cash, wasn't real. The tax that we saved was real, but the actual thing itself wasn't real at all. Okay, so now we now get to the big ones. We spent money on property, plant, and equipment. We spent real money on those items. So we have to now say, take that out. We spent the money. We might have borrowed it, we might have raised it through capital, we might have taken it out of retained earnings, whatever, we actually spent that money to buy that factory, to buy that massive fleet of trucks, to buy whatever. We spent money on that. And then finally, we have to deal with this little mess right here, the change in net operating working capital. And I'm going to do a real life example of this to show you how it works. The change is the net operating working capital this year minus the net operating working capital a year ago. So that would be current assets now minus current liabilities now. And this one would be current assets in the previous year minus current liabilities in the previous year. And I'm going to go real quick here to an actual financial statement to show you these. It looks kind of intimidating. The bottom line is, though, that your short-term current assets and current liabilities are actual sources and uses of real cash. For example, if I have my accounts receivable go up, that actually means that I don't have money that I said I had in the revenue line. I said I made $1,000, but if 800 of that is accounts receivable, then I actually lost $800 in free cash flow. The same is true on the current liability side. Payables, if I can say, well, I paid $500. I had a bill, $500. That's what goes here in SG&A. But if I didn't pay that, it's going to be in accounts payable. So that means that that's a source of cash. I represented that I paid $500, but I didn't pay that. So the accounts are so the current liabilities can represent a source or a use. If I start paying down my bills, well, I had accounts payable last year of $1,000. This year I have accounts payable of $800. That means that I used $200. That doesn't show up on the income statement. Let me show you this in practice. I'm going to bring down a company from the SEC's financial the company filed with the SEC. And I... let me go SEC.gov. I'm going to go to the EDGAR filings. And we're going to look up a company. See what, for lack of any greater creativity, let's look at Ford. Now, they just filed a 10K last year. Now, a little bit of a background. Ford is trying to become a modern company. Last year, it announced that it was going to stop making all vehicles except for its trucks and the Mustang. All other Fords are now history. It had spent a significant amount of money developing electric vehicles. It then said that it was going to dump that operation, spin it off, but kind of like at the last minute, they said, no, we're going to keep it. We're going to keep it. So let's look at the filing, and we're going to go here to the interactive data, and I'm going to download every company in the United States that's public has to provide all of its financial statements in Excel format for anyone to use. That can make for some wonderful, wonderful research documentation, and it is the authoritative. There is no other place where you will get a primary source, because every service that reports income and all that, revenues, expenses, they all are drawing from this right here, because this is the one that the SEC requires. If they lie on these statements, under Sarbanes-Oxley, legislation passed some years back, the officers and directors and the accountants, the outside accountants, and the lawyers all have to sign this. Yeah?
Where will you find the financial report for those companies which are not listed in the stock market?
Say that again.
Where will you find the financial report for the companies which are not listed in the stock market?
Yes. You can find them. Well, okay. Anything that is in the stock market would have to be here.
That's true.
Yeah.
But what if someone is like merging or someone is like coming up like next month, so how will we get to analyze that?
Oh, one thing is you can wait, but there's another thing too, is that many companies, this is something that is kind of good that you brought that up. Many companies actually give previews of what's about to happen, what they see happening. And that's where we get these earnings estimates. Companies will say, okay, here's what we think our financials will look like. Here's what our profit we think will look like, our earnings per share. That comes before, and that is, there's actually something called an earnings call that these companies do with the big Wall Street boys. And everyone can listen in to see what they say. This is what we think is going to happen. Now, is that what really happens? They're under no obligation to be right, but everyone knows that they have to be awfully close because they'd be punished if they're wrong all the time.
This is done for those companies which are already listed but not for the companies which are not listed?
Unfortunately, no. And that's a problem. There are ways that you can get to that information, though. If I told you how to do it, I'd have to kill you then. But and it drives me crazy because there are some very good investment opportunities right now, but they are still private. And I know darn well they're going to be going public soon, but I can't get to those companies' financials. I can't get to them, and it drives me crazy. But in some cases, I have back doors that I can use to get previews of what's going on. Because remember I told you that a company that's going to go public has to work for a year, 2 years with an investment banking group before we see anything about it. Well, there are leakages. They are giving all of their financials to those IBs, the investment banks. They're giving everything. They're disclosing it all. And then that's how the investment banks determine what stock price, what the timing of the offering would be. So those financials are out there, and that's why you have to keep an eye. There are places where you can see them. You can see those. The investment bankers aren't stupid. They are going to work with their wealthiest clients to place the offering. They're going to have to. We've got a trust that's got $10 billion. Yeah, we're going to talk to them about what they're willing to pay for the stock of this company, and we'll show them those financials. Okay? So sometimes you can get those through back doors, what the investment bankers are showing their rich clients about this, because they're going to have to talk to them very quickly to get an idea of what price is going to work for these rich people, these rich trusts, and what terms they're going to be looking at as far as price per share, number of shares, and all that, which means that they have to show these private companies' financials to those people so that their accountants, their finance experts, can rip through them and take them apart and give good advice to the rich clients to talk to the investment bankers about. Yes, it is done. Interestingly enough, some of the biggest sources of money are not anyone that you would recognize, and if you did, you'd say, that's not right. Those people shouldn't be investing in good stuff. Of course they do. It's legal laundering. Let me show you. Let's go here and look at the consolidated. We're going to need three statements. Now, if you're doing this for some project, one thing that these statements, they give you so many financial statements of a company that you just start going blind. I mean, look how many Ford has. Here, 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 here. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. Now, every one of these has some use. Don't get me wrong. But if we're just trying to do free cash flow, we need the income statement, the balance sheet, and the statement of cash flows. Statement of retained earnings might not hurt either. But the one thing that you probably want to do, and this is just some technical advice, get the ones you want, scoot them all together so that you put your income statement first, and then you get your balance sheet. I said you get your balance sheet, for God's sake. Okay, here we go. Now you scoot that over next, okay? Here's your balance sheet, and then you want your statement of cash flows. The reason you're going to want your statement of cash flows, the main reason is that down here, sources and uses of investing activities. This is your capital expenditures, right here. Now, some people say use just the capital spending line. Others say use all of these places where real cash was being used. I kind of favor using the bottom line here, this one, but we'll stick with just capital spending for this. I caution you that you notice that in the formula, it's a minus capital expenditures. But what you see is it's already a negative right here. So be careful that you're not minusing a minusing. Either say minus the absolute value of that $6 billion or plus just the negative $6 billion that you see there. Okay, be careful about that because it's already a negative. And I've had so many poor students, they were so proud of themselves in the advanced classes at the undergrad level, and they got their free cash flow, and I said, you subtracted a negative, so you got a plus, you added when you should have subtracted. I just say, revise and resubmit, and then they bitch at me about it. Can't we just go with what I got there? Yeah, and have it completely wrong. Okay, so anyway, consolidated statement of cash flows. I want to put that one over here on the other side of the balance sheet. Okay, so now, I mean, technically, I put in a worksheet on its own, and I call that one free cash flow. Okay? And that's where I do all of the calculations, or at least some of the major ones. Now, look here on the balance sheet. Why am I on crack or what? That was not what I wanted. Okay. It's up here. Jeez, Zoe. Okay, let's try it this way. Let me get that free cash flow and put it where it belongs. And I do like to do this while you watch so you can see the actual mechanics of doing it. See how I scoot things around to make them so that don't let the Excel spreadsheet control you. You control the spreadsheet. And the worksheets in it, you move those for your convenience. And then you do what you need to them as required. One thing that I'm going to want to do is that change in net operating working capital. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take these 2 years, and I'm going to say 2021 NOWC 2021 and NOWC 2020. And in order to do the net operating working capital, I'm going to have to take the current assets, total current assets for 2021 minus the total current liabilities for 2021. There's been $18 billion in net operating working capital in 2021. That's short term. You notice that's a lot of money? Funniest thing was that for years, long ago, Illinois State University had an undergraduate / graduate class, FIL 340. It was called short-term financial management. And it just vanished 10 years ago, 15, they stopped offering it. Who needs that? Just this next semester, the fall semester, they have brought it back and I'll be teaching it because suddenly everyone notices, oh, geez, that's a lot of money in short term. You think? Yeah, $18 billion. You think we might need a course where we teach people about managing that part of the financial statements? Yeah. So now, once I've done that, the cool thing is I can just scoot it over, and there it is for the previous year. Net operating working capital. So let's go over here and start putting together the free cash flow. The first thing we're going to have to do is we're going to need NOPAT. Okay? And then we're going to subtract, or rather we're going to add back depreciation expense. I meant to do, these are just labels. Okay, and then we're going to deal with minus the capital expenditures. And then we're going to subtract the change in net operating working capital. And I don't mean to put a minus there. Just know the formula. Okay. So now, we got this line, okay, so let's insert here. This is 2021. So NOPAT, well, let's do NOPAT. That would equal operating income. The hell is operating? There it is. Sorry. $4 billion minus the taxes. So that would be times 1 minus 0.21. Operating income. 1 minus. Try that one more time. 1 minus the top marginal tax bracket, which right now is 21%. And I'm going to put this up on your site so that you have this sheet. I'd rather have you just watch and see me do it right here. So our net operating profit after taxes, NOPAT, that is our earnings from operating functions of the company. Now we're going to add back the depreciation expense, and we'll do all this, but I've got to find depreciation expense. Some companies list it as a separate line in the income statement. Most companies don't anymore. It used to be you had to do it, but now companies don't. So where are the, it's in here somewhere, we just don't know. It's probably buried here in selling, administrative, and other expenses, but it's hidden. So you don't know where it is. So what we have to do is we have to go over here to the consolidated. Didn't I put that over here somewhere? I didn't. I have to go back and find my statement of cash flows. There it is. I'm going to scoot this over too. I thought I did that, but I didn't apparently. So there it is. Now look up here. There it is, right there. You see it? So what we'll need to do here is go back, free cash flow, and say equals, and then we go over here and we find that line right there. Okay, got that one. Now, capital expenditures, that will be on the statement of cash flows too. Now, this is the one you have to be careful about because it's already a negative. The way I usually do it is I say take the absolute value of what the cost was. Dang on it. There it is. Now, you go down here to investing activities. Like I said, traditionally, we just look at this line right here, but sometimes we say, look at the whole story. Now, you notice something? That if you look at just what they have spent on property, plant, and equipment, that is a negative $6.2 billion. But if you look at all of the other things that they did that brought money in, they actually come out with a positive here. Okay? So we're just going to take this guy right here for the purposes. I believe the book takes just the capital expenditures line, okay? Now, the change in net operating working capital. I got the pieces of it together, so we'll say equals the net operating working capital this period minus the net operating working capital in the previous period. Notice here that your short-term operations, your balance sheet, absorbed $1.2 billion of money. Something they threw a lot more money at than they brought in. If you want to look over here very quickly and have a look at it. Okay. Their current assets went down. That would be a source of money because they collected. Let me look at what happened. Oh, look at that. They collected a lot of receivables. Do you see how the receivables in 2020 were $42 billion and the receivables by 2021 had fallen to $32 billion? That means they collected $210 billion. That's a source of money. Now, where in the hell? Okay, here's one. Their inventory went up from $10.8 billion to $12.1 billion. So that would be a drain. They got more inventory. They spent money on more inventory. Okay? So on net, though, they actually generated almost $8 billion by lowering their current assets. So what the hell happened in their current liabilities? Oh, they paid off a bunch of bills right there. Oh. Okay, so their current liabilities, they paid off a bunch of bills, so they actually used about $7 billion there. So why the hell is that? Okay, yeah, that's it. Okay, so they paid off a bunch of bills. They lowered their accounts payable. And they generated money, but not as much, by collections and things like that in their current assets. So on balance, their net change was to increase their total amount of money in short term because they collected more from accounts receivable than they spent paying off bills. Let me say that again. They generated money, a lot of money, $10 billion almost, $9 billion, by collecting receivables. They spent a bunch of money by paying off That's not what they did. That's the other liabilities. They cut down something. They paid off something. I don't know what, but they paid off something. But they didn't spend as money paying off here as they generated up here collecting receivables. So the ultimate was that they actually generated some money from the change in net operating working capital. They generated about $1.3 billion. So now here we go. Free cash flow. Would equal your NOPAT plus, add back your depreciation expense, minus your capital expenditures. Minus your capital expenditures, minus the change in net operating working capital, which is minus a minus, which would be a plus to free cash flow. Free cash flow, $5.9 billion. For 2021. Not shabby at all. That explains very well why the company in 2021 had that very strong upsurge in return on the stock. This is a healthy company. This is a very healthy company. I was tempted to do Tesla, but Tesla, if you do the free cash flow of Tesla, you will see staggering negative free cash flows. I mean, it is, and again, as I've said before, this is money that has to be paid. It came from somewhere. You can't just say, whoops, last year, 8 $1 billion in negative free cash flow. We'll do better this year. No, you've got bills you had to pay up there. How the hell did you pay them? And that in, therein lies why the stock keeps going up, is because there are so many Wall Street banks, investment banks, and trading firms, and prop houses, and dark houses that are so heavily invested in Tesla that they're just going to have to keep throwing money at it, because if they don't throw money at it, they will lose multiples of that when the Tesla stock crashes. If they don't keep feeding that monkey is going to fall down on their roof as an 800-pound gorilla. So they have to just keep pumping the money in the back door to keep that, keep them afloat. Is that something unusual? No. The story is, and I'll get back to this in a minute, but one quick story. Back in before the crash in 2008, there were financial analysts like me who were doing free cash flow analysis of banks, of the 10 largest banks in the world, and we were seeing staggering negative free cash flows. I mean, just staggering. And we were calling for a crash of the banking system of the world. We were calling it. And we looked like a bunch of conspiracy theorists because it didn't happen. And we were... The ones, some friends of mine and peers of mine, they were financially destroyed because they were calling for basically the end of the world, and it didn't happen. Free cash flow analysis is wrong. Well, and you know, we even their investment bank people, the backers were saying, yeah, their free cash flow is vastly negative. We're not going to put any more money into these banks. These banks have been living off welfare for years from us. We're not going to do anything. They were actually planning for a complete realignment of the global banking system, back down to smaller, much more distributed financial enterprise. And it did not happen. And in 2011, there was a freedom of information request by a news service for some documents from one of these ginormous banks. And somehow the bank accidentally provided, under the Freedom of Information Act, a memo that had to do with a mechanism that had been in place since 2007 that was providing, at the time of 2011, it had already provided $7.7 trillion of government treasury money to the 10 largest banks, the too big to fails. That was where the free cash flow was being filled in, and we didn't know it. Well, the news service was about to publish this. The bank found out what was about to happen. All the banks got together and sued in federal court to stop the publication of this back channel free cash flow fill-in. The Treasury Department of the United States, and this was under Barack Obama, and the Federal Reserve under Ben Bernanke's chairmanship, both filed friend of court briefs on behalf of the banks because they were part of this scheme, saying, gag them, don't let them publish this. The federal judge was a woman in Washington. Oh, she was just a crab. She said, like hell, I'm going to stop this. And so it was told to everyone, and no one gave a damn. What is it now? How much free cash flow is being filled in, negative free cash flow? As of 2018, it had reached about $18 trillion in filling in negative free cash flows for the 10 largest banks in the world. So there you go. They are, if you want to talk about a welfare queen, you got 10 of them. Why do we do this? Because we can't afford to let those banks fail. Why can't we afford to let them fail? Because they are actually the cash management enterprise, the investment banking structure for the United States government. All of the transactions, the money flows in and out of the government, go through those 10 largest banks. Government can't let them fail because that would be the essentially the entire financial arm of the federal government collapsing. Now, how do we do? What do we do with this? Now, there are fancy schemes, and the book, thank God, doesn't go through the really complicated ones. How do we see what the future holds for this? One way would be to come up here in every year and project the revenues individually, one by one, and get the individual free cash flows year by year, adjusting the revenues. Growth, decline, growth, in some kind of an analysis. And then just do each free cash flow. And in many cases, they just say, all right, what were the percentages on this year? NOPAT, what was depreciation expense as a percent of NOPAT? What was capital expenditures as a percent of NOPAT? What was the change in net operating working capital as a percent of NOPAT? They would actually just do percentages based upon the revenues and then move from there. That's all they would do. And then that's how you would project free cash flow. And usually we do it over a period of, let's say, 10 years, and then we find the present value. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do it in the really dirtiest way possible. And thank heaven the book does a version of this. We just say, all right, let's take it. No, I don't want to do that. I want to do 2022. And then we're going to take it out here. Let's say we take it out to 2030. That should be enough. Didn't mean to do that. Okay, now I'm not going to kill myself on this one too much. Like I said, the book does a nice job. They're going to just say, okay, apply a growth rate. If it is an old company, there is no crime in saying that we should expect overall a fairly constant growth rate of free cash flow. If you don't want to guess at one, you would look at free cash flow for the last 2-3 years and say, what has it average been for the last 2 or 3 years, the growth of free cash flow? Let's say that you do that and you come up with a 2% growth rate for free cash flow, okay? So what we would then do is say that this one equals that times 1 plus that. I think this will work. No, it won't. I'll have to do it the hard way. And this one equals that times 1 plus that. Oops, I got to put a parenthesis in there. Now I can do it. I'm pretty sure I forgot to put an absolute on that. Okay. So now we're just going to say, let's project it out to 2030. And then what we're going to do is we're going to take the present value. Whoops, don't want to do it there. Equals, they use NPV for this, which is technically not right. Okay, the rate. Now, let's take the weighted, you use the weighted average cost of capital of the company. Now, for Ford, I believe that rate is about 5%. We're just going to use a whack of, 5%. And then we're going to say, find the NPV of all of these. it's about a $50 billion NPV. About. So now, what does this tell us? How many shares of stock does Ford have outstanding? Okay. Number of shares outstanding of the company? I don't know what it is. It's probably about 500 million, I think. So now, the price per share, the intrinsic price per share. We would take this number. Now that actually, I'm going to have to scale that because that's in 10,000. So I'd have to times that to get billions by 10,000s to 100,000s to millions, 10 millions, 100 millions, billions. And then divide it by the number of shares outstanding. And that's, I wrote that wrong. That's 500 million. So I'd need three more zeros on that. No, two more zeros. I gave it one too many. There you go. That would be the intrinsic price per share, based upon free cash flow. If Ford is above that right now, we would say that the company is overvalued. If Ford is below that right now, we would say that the company is undervalued. But this is how we get intrinsic price per share. It's just take the free cash flows. Now, 10 years is good enough for these. Some people say 20 years or whatever. But we get the present value of the future expected free cash flows, and then we divide that by the number of shares outstanding. That should be the underlying economic intrinsic value per share of the stock. And in this case, it looks like it's about $100 a share. So what, as the last part of this class, let's get back here. What is Ford? Ford is selling a lot above that right now, I think. No, it's selling a lot below that right now. Let me go back. Did I screw that up? How many shares do they have? Let me do this. 500. One, two, three. There it is. That's what was wrong. I'm sorry. The intrinsic price per share is about $9.98. Right now, Ford, the market is pricing it at $16.66 a share. So as you can see from this, it is somewhat overpriced, which would be a sell signal. Yeah, it was that number right there that was the problem. Is this realistic? Obviously, there were a lot of quick, dirty things I did in there. But this is how you do it. This is how you do free cash flow. Now, I'm going to say that's all I have for you tonight, and I thank you.